This Spokane Public Radio Health Forum has received support from the Journal of Business, the Inland Northwest source for local healthcare industry news, serving the business community in print, online, and on the go. SpokaneJournal.com. And Kaufman & Associates, a Native American consultant firm specializing in event coordination, multimedia product design, research, and organizational consultation. Details at KaufmanInc.com. Also, Providence Healthcare, serving the region for generations through knowledge, skills, and experienced caregivers dedicated to helping create healthier communities together. Information at phc.org. And WSU, opening the state's second public medical school with the first 2 years of education in Spokane. More at spokane.wsu.edu.
And good evening and welcome to our annual Spokane Public Radio Health Forum. We call it Suicide Awareness. We know this is a touchy subject and may not be easy listening for some in our audience. Tonight we're going to take a look at the issue of suicide, how big a problem it is for many demographic and social groups, how it's treated, how it can be prevented, and hopefully hear some success stories of how some have been able to work past it. We also want to discuss the related topic of what is known as physician-assisted death in Washington's Death with Dignity Law, which allows those with terminal illness to relieve their pain and suffering with lethal medication. I'm going to be posing questions to our panelists and some special guests in our audience that are seated up front on several different topics, but this is also an opportunity for you to ask specific questions of these experts. And because it's a sensitive topic and you may want to remain anonymous, you can write your question down on a card if you prefer to do it that way, and I will pose it to our panelists. We have Nisha standing by over here with some cards that she can give you for the course of the next couple hours. Otherwise, you can also come forward and ask a question personally, but we ask you try to limit your time to, say, a minute or two if you do that. I also want to mention that we have a resource reading list online on our website, SpokanePublicRadio.org, with a number of books and materials that can help if you're facing this type of issue. We're going to save the audience questions for the last portion of the program tonight. I see we have a pretty big audience here, so I'll try to get to that, say, in about an hour or so, maybe an hour and 15 minutes. This program is going to be broadcast in the next week over Spokane Public Radio stations KPBX and KSFC, as well as Spokane City Cable 5, and they are filming that tonight. So here are the panelists tonight. We have Dr. Kevin Hyde, a licensed psychologist who's worked in the mental health profession for over 30 years in his current position as a psychologist with the Department of Psychiatry, Providence Sacred Heart Medical Center, as well as Director of Psychology Services for Providence Psychology Clinic and Providence Medical Group. He's provided a wide range of inpatient and outpatient psychological services to patients of all ages and specializes in assessment and treatment of children and adolescents. Stacy Cornwall is the Director of Crisis Response Services for Frontier Behavioral Health and a licensed mental health professional, experienced working with youth, adults, and the elderly in suicide crisis situations. As a designated mental health professional, she's provided crisis intervention and involuntary treatment assessment in Spokane for 17 years. She is on the executive leadership team for Spokane Suicide Coalition and active in other collaborative efforts with community providers, law enforcement, and area colleges and schools. Arlene Hinckley is a third-generation Washingtonian. She grew up in Seattle, has a BA from Carleton College in Minnesota, and an MSW from the University of Washington. She has long had an interest in civil rights and health care. She has worked as a social worker with high-risk pregnant women and infants, and her work in Missouri convinced her of the need for better end-of-life care and opportunities for terminally ill adults to control their last days. She's now the board member and volunteer client advisor for End of Life Washington. Police Chief Scott Hogue is the Chief of Police for the Post Falls, Idaho Police Department. Chief Hogue began his career with the Post Falls Department in 1986, and in August of 2009, he was appointed the chief. Chief Hogue is a graduate of the 201st session of the FBI National Academy in Quantico, Virginia. Most recently, he served as president of the Montana-Idaho chapter of the FBI National Academy Associates and is current president of the Idaho Chiefs of Police Association. And Cheryl Shepard began her career in chaplaincy in South Dakota and completed her training through Gonzaga in 2002. She joined Hospice of Spokane in 2005 and has served clients and their families for 12 years. She received certification in death and grief studies in 2005. She's facilitated survivors of suicide loss groups for the last 10 years. A survivor herself, Cheryl has a heart for the bereaved and is currently obtaining certification as a creative grief support practitioner. Taking a look at the issue of suicide, the risk factors include everything from mental disorders like depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, personality disorder, alcoholism, or substance abuse. Others are impulsive acts due to stress, such as things from financial difficulties, trouble with relationships, or possibly even actions like bullying. We want to start by asking Dr. Kevin Hyde, some specific questions about counseling and the like. Kevin, talk just for a bit about some of the warning signs that people may see in someone that may be planning to take their own life. I mean, it may be something subtle sometimes, but can you give us a general idea of what to look for?
Sure. Well, first thing I want to say is that suicide is not a static sort of a process. It's a dynamic process. And people that are somewhere in their suicide journey or contemplating this, struggling with different sorts of mental illness that Steve talked about, people move in and out of crisis that may involve some sort of suicidal ideation or even suicide attempt. So the practitioner or the family member needs to remain vigilant. We know that 90% of people who attempt suicide, die by suicide, have some sort of mental illness. Only 1/3 of those are in treatment. Kind of alarming. So most of the people that struggle with suicide probably will not be in treatment, but they will be involved in families. So it's incumbent upon family members to stay vigilant and to listen. You know, there's an old saying that people that are suicidal may not ask for help, but that does not mean they don't want help. So many people that are struggling with suicide, they're somewhere on their suicide journey, will say things that indicate that they're struggling, indicate that they're suffering, indicate that they're experiencing hopelessness. So hopelessness is probably one of the biggest things to look for. Hopelessness, prior suicide attempts, of course, probably the best predictor of future behavior. Loss, isolation, loneliness. People talk about, if folks talk about suicide, they'll never do it. That's a myth. Don't believe that. Again, people, your family members will drop all sorts of lines that will indicate that somewhere along the way they're experiencing thoughts of self-harm. Listen to those and then be open to listen. Not necessarily to give advice or to scold, but to listen and to get them into treatment. Very important.
When somebody thinks they've seen these kind of warning signs, what do you recommend somebody do if they see this in a family member or a loved one? I mean, who can they talk to initially? I mean, without having to say make an appointment with a psychologist or some of that nature, what would be the first steps that you guys would recommend?
I think they can call the crisis line.
Yeah, and I just want to throw this out there also, that we're going to be talking about a lot of signs and symptoms and things that people say. And sometimes when I've been involved in things like this before, people are like, oh, that kind of sounds like me, or that sounds like my person, my loved one, or whatever. And so I just want to balance that with what we're talking about is not just that someone is moody or is having, you know, poor sleep or poor appetite or is having hopelessness, because that could be any one of our youths who's going through puberty, or if, you know, someone lost their job. Those are normal reactions to life. What we're really looking at is if there's a noticeable change in things like their mood or their sleep patterns or their appetites or their hopelessness, their performance at school or work. Those are the things that we're looking for, is that noticeable change. And if you come across this, you know, because you observe it or someone shares this information with you, then we have quite a few different resources in our community. We also have quite a few resources nationwide. And locally, we have crisis hotlines through First Call for Help or through crisis response services that people can actually call. And they can call and be anonymous, or they can identify who they are, and it depends on what kind of level they need. Some people call on behalf of other people as well and are looking for advice on how to just talk to someone. Again, these are services that are 24/7. These are services that can result in also linking with a mental health professional. So if it's a situation where someone needs or wants to talk with someone face-to-face, then we can help make those arrangements as well.
And how do you set that up? In other words, quick question. Some people may be thinking, how hard is this to, I guess, afford? I didn't plan on asking this, but it occurs to me that if someone's considering maybe getting a counselor, do they have to have an insurance kind of thing? Do they need a health insurance, or how do they go about doing that? Maybe
sure.
From your agency?
For our crisis services that we offer to all of Spokane County, each county has their own crisis system. We don't have any sort of fee. You don't have any sort of medical insurance requirement. It's a free service that we offer on a 24/7 basis. And our jurisdiction is all of Spokane County, but like I said, there's other crisis systems in other counties if you're coming or traveling from a different area. And we can talk with people over the phone, or we can go to them. And we often will go to their homes, or we go to schools, we go to hospitals. We have a system in our community where there's actually a lot of different areas and avenues that you can access crisis services. And it just depends on that level. The first step is knowing when to call and who to call. And so what I would suggest is if it's a emergency, you know, someone is actively doing something, that is a 911 call. If it's not an emergency and you or your person are trying to seek assistance, then that could be a call to our crisis hotline, which is First Call for Help. And I did put brochures and information out on the tables as well.
Okay.
That talks about how to access that.
Kevin, I want to ask you that same thing, just kind of as a quick follow-up. If somebody does have an insurance plan, though, I think there is mental health counseling on just under the ACA as it exists now that does cover at least some office visits for mental health, or do you know the answer?
They have insurance?
Yeah, if they do have insurance?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Then this is either for Stacy or Kevin. How difficult is it to talk to parents about concerns that their child may be contemplating suicide? I mean, I don't know how you'd get in this situation if you hadn't yet talked to the, let's say you hadn't talked to the child yet, and you're trying to figure out what's going on, and you're dealing with the parents initially. Is that a difficult thing to do, or how do you go about that?
You want to go?
Sure.
Either one of you guys.
I think for people who have not ever experienced or been around someone who has had suicide or thoughts or gestures, it is very difficult. It's very uncomfortable to ask that question, especially if it's your own person, your loved one, your child, to ask the question because sometimes you don't want to know the answer. And so depending on how you ask, it can really have an effect on how that person responds. And so what we tell parents or even friends, family members, other people is you ask them, are you thinking about killing yourself? And you do it in a neutral way without that sort of inflection like, are you thinking about killing yourself? Or you're not thinking about killing yourself, because that has some level of judgment or that it's wrong. And the person that is having those or that may be having those thoughts might try and protect you and be like, oh no, absolutely not. But if it's said in a very, you know, neutral, supportive way, then that might result in some of that kind of decreased anxiety or even some relief, because now it's opened communication to that individual. So now your person says yes, and so now you need to know what to do about that. And we talked about some of the other questions that you could ask, you know, is there someone that I can help, you know, talk to about? Are you willing to talk and get some help with someone? I don't know how far you want me to go down this.
No, that's fine, because my follow-up was kind of too, how do you convince a family member or a friend to seek counseling? Is that kind of, I mean, talk a little bit about that for a sec. If you had to talk to somebody about a friend, somebody presents it that my friend may be suicidal, how do you convince the family member or friend to seek counseling? How do they go about that?
The first step is knowing what that first step is, and that is knowing that we do have resources in our community to help people that are having suicidal thoughts or that have made attempts. And so offering that as an option, are you willing to talk with someone? Is there someone that you trust that you'd want to talk with about this? If there's some immediate need where you need to, like for example, the person says, yes, I am thinking about killing myself. I've thought about taking these pills that I have in my closet or, you know, whatever. Then working with them about, you know, would you be willing to, you know, remove those pills, let me take those pills, you know, do some sort of safety planning with them around that to try and, you know, minimize that level of risk until you can get them some assistance.
And when you are counseling somebody specifically now that has threatened to kill themselves, I mean, what kind of tact do you take in your discussions to convince them that that's the wrong idea? What do you tell them?
You know, whenever we work with someone who was dealing with a very serious life crisis, and suicide is certainly, you know, the most daunting crisis. We always need to remember that it's the relationship that will drive the quality of the evaluation, the quality of the counseling session. It is the relationship. So, as odd as it may sound, the most important thing we can do as helpers is to listen, provide opportunities for the person who's suffering to talk with us, to open a window that will allow us to enter their phenomenological field and understand the level of their pain. Advice doesn't go a long ways. Giving flippant responses that we might want to provide because we're shocked, we're scared, we're trembling as parents or family members, and we want to talk someone out of suicide. There are risks to that. People move away from us. People shut down. People do not see us as someone who really can begin to understand their world. And so that very thing we hope will happen, we undermine by moving quickly to fix as opposed to understand. Once we understand, then we can assist in conversation that I think will help move a patient toward being able to listen to our plea that they access help. But first, we have to listen, and I know that can be a frustrating response, frustrating answer to the question, because we want to keep someone we love from making that forever decision, as Paul Quinet refers. But it's not as easy as just sitting down and convincing someone that they don't want to die.
But it sounds like what you're saying too is that they're hoping they can find somebody that listens, and maybe right. Because you're in a position as a medical person, are they trusting you more than when they're trying to talk to a family member? Because a lot of times, family members would be more than likely to be the person that really wants to listen. But has it just hit them that this is now an official person that's really paying attention, or how?
What I don't
is
know
the
that it's trust
dynamic, or
I don't know that it's trust. Somehow they feel like they're not burdened by having to take care of whoever the listener is, having to take care of mom and dad and dealing with their shock or their sadness, can just talk about their own situation with someone who hopefully they trust, because that would be foundational, but more importantly, someone who will allow them to feel what they feel without having to be scarred themselves.
Well, do you eventually get into the, and this is for both of you, do you eventually get into a situation where you're kind of telling them the general concept, you know, you have a lot more good things ahead in your life? Is that kind of what you finally get around to, or no? Is that
hopefully
kind of
you'll
this
get
discussion?
Around to that yeah. quickly. Hopefully.
I absolutely agree, and I would echo everything that he said. And I hope what people get out of this, if anything, is that they know that asking the question is the first step. Listening, right. I mean, there's so much that we hear from people about what has made a difference. In fact, there's this one gentleman who, it's always stuck with me, and he was someone who was on the Golden Gate Bridge, and he was on the bridge for 90-some minutes. And what he said was, the officer that had responded, the only thing he did was listen. I think he listened for like 92 minutes, and he said, that is what saved my life. He didn't tell me what I should do. He didn't try and fix it. He didn't try and, you know, shame. He didn't have any sort of judgmental tone. He wasn't imposing his own opinions. He listened. And the way he listened is he also validated. And that's a hard thing for people to make sense of when it comes to suicide, if you've never experienced those thoughts yourself. And what I would say to that is, you don't have to be able to relate to the situation or the suicidal ideation, but you definitely can relate to feelings of sadness or fear or hopelessness, and those are feelings that you can connect then with that individual and show that you're really validating what they're saying and that you believe them and that you want to help. And then at some point, you collaborate with them to say, what is that next step, and do you want to talk with someone further about this?
Hmm. Can you two maybe explain, you know, what it's like essentially to go into counseling? What would somebody anticipate? How does it work? I mean, they might have the image, we talked about this earlier behind this, in the green room, about people may think, is it like a psychology situation? Am I laying on a couch? Or just give us an overall view of what it's like for somebody that may be considering that they may need to do some counseling, just generally.
Well, there may be a couch involved.
Okay.
No, there won't be. Counseling is kind of a scary thing for lots of people.
Yeah.
For many, it's not. I again remember that 1/3 of people who attempt to take their lives or they take their lives are not in treatment. I think again the listening to build that sense of I understand, and there's help for you. There's hope. You know, extend the ladder before you tell somebody they need counseling. We need to have worked on our own relationship with that individual and extended that ladder of hope. Again, of Paul Quinet saying, extend mm-hmm. that ladder of hope. And we must communicate that we believe that there are other options today for that individual other than to die. And to engage them in that same conversation. And then to believe enough in this individual and communicate that and believe enough in the process of therapy and medical treatment that we can communicate that with some certainty and we will be believed. And so there's a level of trust that, and maybe the individual follows that because they've trusted us.
Go ahead.
Steve, could I add to that? You know, one of the things that
get on your mic a little closer.
Sorry. Yeah. One of the things that we work on in law enforcement is, you know, suicide is the number one killer of police officers across this country. We lose about 130 police officers a year to a variety of different deaths, but we lose about 2 to 3 times that many by suicide. And one of the things that we're trying to do is to get officers and their coworkers to look at counseling as a sign of strength and not a sign of weakness. You know, for so long, there's been this stigma there that, you know, if you go to counseling, it's a sign of weakness. And we're trying to change that, and I'm involved in a program, a nationwide program, where we talk about that to try to get officers to be thinking about going and getting some help. You know, it's a difficult job, and go in and talk to someone and work through some of those issues.
Do we know why the rate is so high for police? Have there been any studies to indicate the reasons? Is it just such a high-stress job, or?
I think that's the biggest part of it. I think it's a high-stress job. Officers are seeing a lot of things that people should not have to see and have to deal with. I think there is has been in the past a lack of resources for emergency responders, and this just isn't police officers. We've seen a significant number of firefighters and EMTs where suicide is a problem as well. And so I think it's a resource issue. And then the other big part of it is I think there's, you know, that feeling that if I go and get some assistance, it's going to be looked at negatively. And that's something that we've really got to change in emergency services and in a variety of different professions. Of it's not a weak thing to do. It shows a sign of strength that you're willing to recognize the problem and you're willing to get that help. And if you're a coworker, it's a sign of strength that you're willing to recognize the problem and help that person get the assistance through EAP or whatever it is.
Okay. And Kevin, this might be a question for you, but anybody can chime in. I'm wondering if suicide's a sort of a spur of the moment thing for some. In other words, there are people who seem fine and maybe they're not depressed and not thinking of suicide, but are there cases where some sort of incident or event sets them off and they choose to commit suicide? And I'm thinking that in part because we hear many stories of people saying, wow, you know, this person took their own life and we had no idea it was coming, and they never even voiced any type of concern or expressed any kind of depression or anything. Do we know cases where just something maybe even minor sets somebody off? Or
there are cases like that. I think most of the literature suggests that while impulsivity might be a factor in some attempts, some completed suicides, that impulsivity is will never be the reason why someone died. Again, suicide is a dynamic process. People move in and out. The individual who impulsively ends his life, to say that he is not somewhere demonstrated or sent warning signs would probably be incomplete. So while death by firearm, there is a high level of impulsivity involved in that, but the person who chooses death by firearm to say that they chose to shoot themselves in a moment of impulsivity without any sort of pre-thought is probably incomplete.
So we don't have maybe documented cases of, and I guess this is hard to even quantify, but somebody who life had been for them probably pretty good, but something set them off, just a certain type of incident set them off. Is that ringing any bells with you, or is that?
There are three factors that a lot of times suicidologists will look to, situational, psychological, biological. Situational, things happen. Person loses a job, person loses a marriage, person's diagnosed with a terminal illness. Situations that are the adolescent who is bullied on social media, you know, situations that lead to feelings of hopelessness, humiliation, loss. Psychological, those thoughts, feelings that we deal with as individuals that help us make sense of who we are and who we are in the world, that sometimes we need help with those. Biological, we know that many people who choose to end their lives really are experiencing some sort of neurobiological deficiency in terms of neurotransmitters that help regulate mood and behavior, or the substances involved. So there are three components. And so again, the person who's just doing fine in the world and all of a sudden chooses to leave the world, there's probably more to their situation than what we think.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about some of the suicide rates for a moment and kind of focus on our region, but give you an overall view. So worldwide, approximately 0.5% to 1.5% of the people die by suicide. It's a mortality rate of 11.6 per 100,000 persons per year. Now that's the worldwide rate. Rates of suicide have apparently increased by 60% from the 1960s to the present day, with the increases seen primarily in the developing world. Globally, as of, and the latest figures I had was for up to 2009, suicide was the 10th leading cause of death. For every suicide that results in death, there are between 10 and 40 attempted suicides. The suicide rate in various countries, the U.S. is at 11.4 people per 100,000. Canada, very similar, 11.1. China, 12.7. And India is as high as 23.2. Now, breaking that down locally, Washington State, the suicide rate is 15.6 per 100,000. Idaho, the 2015 rate was 21.9 per 100,000. So kind of a general question for you to see if there have been any studies in this. Idaho's rate is particularly high. Coeur d'Alene has the highest rate in the state. For all of you here, and this could even include our sub-panelists here. We have some folks down at this table, and I can introduce you in a moment, but... For these rates, do we have any idea why the rates would be this high for our region? Are there any studies on the climate or anything like that nature? Or, I mean, I don't know. These rates are so high.
We have pretty easy access to firearms, and there are many firearms. You know, I think in Wyoming, the rate may be the highest, and it's also the state where there are most guns in homes. So I know that's a touchy subject, so maybe I should leave that alone.
But that's why we're here, though. Okay. We can talk about touchy subjects.
Our rural communities, I think, also play a factor in that, maybe not as great as access to outpatient treatment or even crisis services could contribute.
Okay. Another, and some of the other demographics I saw that were interesting, and maybe we don't know these answers, but I wanted to throw out the question. Washington State, the figures who have the highest rate of suicides of the Asian population, and I found that was 26 per 100,000, which was quite a bit higher than the other groups. Any theories why that would be be the case, or anybody looked into that?
Maybe a reluctance to ask for help and reluctance to see the need for help, and maybe culturally related.
Here's another factoid of interest. This is a CDC study. For industries, the suicide rate in the construction and extraction industries, which we have, you know, I'm thinking mining industry for one, this is really amazing. 53 suicide deaths out of a population of 100,000. And that's second only to the farming, fishing, and forestry industries. 84.5 per 100,000. Dr. Sowers is at the table over here. I don't think we have a mic. I'm just asking because I was told you may know some more about this. Dr. Lou Sowers, psychologist. Do you know anything about the rates for these type of workers and industries and the like?
One of the primary issues I would take a look at is if they're primarily male populations in those groups. That's one of the issues we see with police officers. Men have suicide rates 4 to 5 times as high as women do. And so that's certainly one issue that I would look to there.
And any studies to indicate why this would be? I'm just curious if there have been specific studies to tell us why, for example, these, you know, not just males, but those industries or anything, or just high stress maybe, huh?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Let's talk about the survivors group. Cheryl Shepherd, you run a group here in Spokane that's for those who've lost loved ones to suicide, which obviously those folks face special challenges. And that's got to be a difficult topic to share with friends or other family members. What kind of things can you tell family members how to cope with this type of grief? I mean, what specific things can you tell them?
Well, I don't think that we in the group tell people how to cope. We share with each other how we've been able to cope primarily. But if I was to choose something, I think what I would say is don't isolate yourself, because healing can't happen in isolation. And when people can come together in a shared community that knows the pain of that kind of loss and share that together, there's greater possibility for healing to happen. So I would say, you know, don't isolate for certain. And if you can, find someone, you know, whether it's a friend or a support group or a counselor, that, as you were saying, you know, you can have a relationship with, a trusting relationship that will allow you to bear your burden to another human being that is willing to just be a witness to it and not try to fix it. And that's often what we do inside the group, is we share the burden that we carry due to this kind of loss in a way that allows us to be unburdened, because we've let it to the outside as opposed to keeping it inside.
And tell us a little bit just more about how your group operates. I mean, do you meet monthly, or
we meet
what do
weekly.
You do every week?
We have
week?
A weekly okay. meeting. And as far as I know, we have the only survivors of suicide loss group in our community, and it is an exclusive group to that kind of loss. And grief, you know, has many faces and sides to it, but suicide grief clothes are different than regular grief clothing. There's a lot more to your grief when you've experienced it because of a suicide than just sadness and sorrow. There's, you know, guilt and shame and anger, and society still looks at suicide, unfortunately, as a stigma, and I do think that's changing. I think it's improving, where it's not the stigma that it used to be, but it still is, and because of that, people will withdraw, pull in, and again, that's why there's such value in group support.
And you'd mentioned that too, it's like a survivor's guilt type thing. Is it mostly that you're just talking amongst each other and kind of consoling each other and telling people, like, well, I experienced what you did and here's what I did? Is that kind of what
yeah,
it is?
Yeah, that's a lot of what happens in the group. And just being in the company of other people who know your experience can be incredibly helpful.
How long has your group been in existence?
It's going on 11 years.
Okay. You had mentioned that this topic, talk a little bit about how folks should respond if they know a friend has lost someone from suicide. That's a difficult topic to broach with somebody. And
it is.
What kind of advice can you give them?
Well, to listen. I mean, that's the chief thing, is to be able to listen. To listen to the pain of the loss, perhaps to listen to the description of that pain, of the way the person died, and to withhold any judgment around it, of course. I often say in our group, you know, you need to wear out 3 set of ears before you're probably going to feel any different. Because people need to say the story over and over and over again. And they need to do that with someone they trust, someone that they can share that deep sorrow with, and someone that they can even define what they saw. Many times people, you know, witnessed the death of their loved one or found their loved one, and that, you know, is like a PTSD. It needs to be tended to with a trusting person that can take that in. Not all people can do that. And so to have a group that allows people to share that out loud can really aid in their healing.
Do many of your members, I mean, you've been in existence that time frame, are there people that have been going to the meetings the entire time, or do
no.
some people eventually start to feel a lot better
yeah.
about it, or
yeah.
or no?
Yeah, uh-huh. We see a lot of movement inside the group, and people come and go. Our group happens to be what we call an open group, so we have no set format. We're just always there. And so people come and go as they need to. And sometimes people feel a real need to be there, and other times they don't. Sometimes it's an anniversary date that comes along, and it might be several years ago that the suicide happened. But all of a sudden, the anniversary is there, or a holiday is there, and there's that need to be in community with others who know that kind of loss and can appreciate where you're coming from. And we honor that inside the group.
Okay. And I'm hopeful that we'll have some questions from the audience, too, about sure. specifics, about maybe how they can become involved in that. And we can get back to you on that, too. Let's talk to Police Chief Scott Hoag. And I want to ask you just a few things. And you had mentioned about responding or about your officers with suicide issues. But we want to talk about your own suicide awareness program. But before we do that, let's talk just a little bit about just the routine for a police officer in Post Falls. And I'm sure it's very similar to Spokane. And we talked about this back in the green room, but the general question, I was surprised when you answered this back there, how often do officers respond to suicide calls? It was way more than I'd ever anticipated.
Yeah, our officers are dealing with this issue on a daily basis. Again, not suicides, but people that are threatening or having those discussions about suicide. We're responding to those calls on a daily basis. To give you a little bit of statistics, you talked about the U.S. having a rate of 11.4 per 100,000. In Kootenai County last year, we were at 27.9. The county next to us was at 66.3.
And the county. Which county is that?
That's Shoshone County.
Oh, okay.
Which would be Wallace in that area.
Okay.
Shoshone County was 48.3, and in Benewah County, which would be St. Mary's, it was 66.3. So we're dealing with some staggering numbers in the Kootenai County area. Idaho has a high suicide rate, and we have a significant number of those up in the what we call Region 1 up in the north. And so we're dealing with it quite frequently.
And is it the, what kind of, you don't have to go into great detail, but the average response, officers show up at the scene and there's a person that's threatening to kill themselves, and how do they deal with that? What do they do?
Well, that's a very good question. And when I first became chief, we recognized that there was a significant gap there for our officers. You know, we were, as it comes to suicide, not many people want to talk about it. But when something happens, it's law enforcement that gets sent to deal with it. And so the first thing that we did is try to put some education together for the community, education for the officers so that they knew how to handle these kind of situations. And there are several different programs that we have, education that we provided to our officers. But the first thing that they're going to do when they get there is they're going to assess the situation and try to determine the validity of the threat. Mm-hmm. They're gonna talk with the person in crisis, with family members, and they're gonna try to get them resources, whatever those resources are that are needed. We also have our victim services unit that is available to come out and provide assistance to those people that are threatening suicide. And there are a variety of different resources that they bring as well. So there's several things that happen. And then, many situations, our officers will transport someone who is suicidal to the hospital. We have a good relationship with Kootenai Health. And we will transport people over there for treatment.
And do you get these? I'm sure you do, but maybe could you talk a bit about what is commonly called officer-assisted suicide? I know we have a lot of these cases happen in Spokane where you respond to a suspect that maybe is holding a weapon or something, but their motive is to try to get the officer to kill them. And how do you deal with that? How can you tell it's that kind of situation? And what do you do to try to avoid doing that?
Well, those are very difficult situations because most of the time for a police officer, they're not aware. They're responding to a call for service. They get there and they're immediately faced with a situation. And what we try to do is to, again, through education, put our officers through these type of scenarios in what's called RBT or reality-based training in advance of them responding so that when they're you know, they can work through these type of calls in a practice scenario so that when they go to one, they know how to handle those kind of things. And what an officer is taught to do is to de-escalate those situations, try and do what they can to, you know, prevent that from happening. But unfortunately, across this country, all too often we see that officers are forced to make lethal decisions and with tragic consequences because the officer has to deal with those kind of decisions.
Have you had some success stories, though, that you can think of where the case where you were pretty sure it was an officer-assisted suicide type scenario, but the officers managed to defuse the situation?
Yeah, I mean, we have had some situations where officers certainly could have used, you know, lethal means to handle that situation, but because of their training and their patience in dealing with the situation have been able to bring that to conclusion, you know, without having to use their firearm. We had a situation, you may have heard about it, at one of our local churches here in the last couple of months where someone had come to the church and wanted to have the officers shoot him. And I think the officers did a great job of negotiating with him and explaining to them that, hey, we have families at home, we have children, we don't want to have to do this. You know, trying to talk through this with this person of, don't do this to us. And,
yeah.
You know, it's very unfortunate that the person took his own life, but he didn't force the officers to do that. So. And there's many other stories. That's just one that has happened recently.
But that makes sense. So the officer tries to show that they too would be affected by what they'd have to do if they had to shoot him or something.
Yeah, absolutely. They try to personalize that situation of explaining to them that, hey, I understand what you're going through. There are some resources out there, but don't make us, you know, do this type of thing. And they will, you know, talk about those kind of things. When that situation's going on.
Okay. Now you have a special program. I don't know if it's unusual or not, but you do follow up with those who've made suicide threats. I mean, after the officer maybe responds to a home or something, then you send counselors. Tell us a little bit about what the program is.
Yeah, you know, so I mentioned that we have a high rate, and there was not in 2008, 2009 a whole lot of resources for our department. I remember as a patrol officer responding to many, many calls where someone had committed suicide. Many times it was juveniles who had committed suicide and their parents were left there distraught and not sure what to do. And we would go and investigate it and leave, and they were just left to sort of, you know, figure it out for themselves. And
yeah.
We have talked about this with our chaplains group and said, you know, there's got to be a better way that we can do this. And so we worked with our victim services. We have counselors that are actually on staff at our department as well as our chaplains. And so every time that we get a threat of suicide, obviously an officer responds and takes the appropriate action, whatever that is. But afterwards, our chaplains will follow up with those individuals. Again, what you're trying to do is to provide hope. You're trying to provide resources. And so many times, it's been successful. You know, we have visited with over 900 people since the inception of this program. Have only had one occurrence where someone has followed through with suicide after we've met with them, and I see that as success. You know, and I've had people come to the office with tears in their eyes and say, you know what, your department saved my life. And those are the things that touch you. You know, that's what it's all about, is if we can save one person's life by going out and just providing some hope, providing that listening ear, it's well worth it to me. And I'm just so proud of our victim services and our chaplains and the work that they do. Most of it's volunteer work. Our chaplains are all volunteers. They volunteer their time to go out and meet with these people and provide that assistance.
And how many times have they gone out to meet with them? I mean, I guess it's probably on a case-by-case basis, but would they continue to meet with them for several months or?
Well, we're committed to going out and one time meeting with them. And we have put together some packets of information. So they come bearing, you know, a gift of a packet, and it's got a lot of great resources that are available in the community, as well as their business card of, hey, you can call me anytime. And I've had our chaplains come to me and say, hey, I've had people call me in the middle of the night saying, hey, I'm in crisis and I need someone to talk to. And they're not counselors, but they can get them some assistance that they need. And it's just been a great tool. But there are some times where they'll meet with them on several occasions, not just that one time.
And quick follow-up, you mentioned their chaplains. Have you ever run into a case where somebody, I mean, is really not religious and didn't, and maybe not resented it, but just didn't think that was the appropriate person to come visit them, or?
Sure, yeah, there's a lot of people that, you know, don't like that faith-based connection, and we get that. And mm-hmm. there are a lot of resources out there that are not faith-based, and the chaplains will point them in that direction and say, here are some assistance, you know, for you. So, you know, the primary goal of our program and our chaplains is just to go out and try to provide resources and be that listening ear. We're not out there to try to fix the problem.
Sure.
We're not out there to do any counseling. We're out there just to say, hey, what's caused this crisis and what can we do to help you through it and get you the resources that you need?
Okay. Now, you talked about a training program, the Mental Health First Aid. What is that exactly?
So that's a national program that we have put all of our officers through. And basically, it's just a mental health program. We've worked with Dr. Sowers a lot. Dr. Sowers has done a lot of consulting with our department, and I give him a lot of credit for the work that he does with law enforcement, both working with law enforcement officers that have been in crisis themselves, as well as providing them training on how to respond to these kind of situations. He's done a tremendous job. But anyways, one of the programs that we use is this Mental Health First Aid. Again, national program. It's basically how to deal and how to respond to someone who's in crisis, a 101 type curriculum. And the thing that we like about it is that the officer or the first responder walks away with some information that they can refer back to mm-hmm. At a later time, and it's a good resource guide. The other one is QPR with Dr. Quinette. We've done a significant amount of training and had his staff come out and work with us as well, and he provides great training for our officers too. So we've provided a series of different educational pieces for our employees.
Okay, and Stacy, let me do a follow-up with you, because that's kind of what your expertise is too, correct? That you also work with other organizations to do group training for counseling, correct?
Sort of. I can speak a little bit to some of that. I co-facilitate the crisis intervention team training here locally, which is the 40-hour training that we offer to law enforcement. We also have EMS and fire that attend, Department of Corrections, our STA bus plaza. People have attended, school resource officers, mental health professionals. It's a pretty collaborative, integrated group, and it's training that is involves identification of different mental disorders like schizophrenia, bipolar, depression, youth issues, adult, elder issues, de-escalation and communication techniques and interventions, and community resources and collaboration. And so that is something that we also incorporate suicide assessment intervention training in. In addition to that, we offer mental health first aid also in this community. In fact, I did bring some brochures about that. If people were interested, we have some upcoming trainings. There's actually one specifically for adults and then another one for youth. And there's other trainings that provide some overview of suicide intervention questions, how to respond, you know, QPR. In fact, QPR has a curriculum where they can target specifically people that are psychotic and how to kind of do that suicide risk assessment with someone who's experiencing hallucinations or drug and alcohol issues or various, you know, specific populations. There's also another training in our community, and it's called ASSIST. And that, I believe, is a two-day training and also covers those issues of how do you identify it and what do you do. And then we have some things through our youth suicide prevention programs. In our community, we actually have a pretty wide variety of opportunity for professionals and for family, for individuals, people who've never experienced this that are curious, or people who are wanting just to be more of a gatekeeper. And a gatekeeper is someone who has interactions with individuals pretty regularly and can pick up noticeable things. Like, for example, a postman would notice that mail was piling up, and then we would train them on how to look for those things and then report it and who to report it to.
And so, yeah, that's fine. And so there's training offered, though. If somebody has like a business or something and they wanted to do some group training, they could maybe contact you or look, at least check the brochures that are
Absolutely.
Outside.
Absolutely. Each of these trainings have their own websites, have their own schedules, facilitators.
And when you said QPR, I wasn't quite sure. What are you referring to? What is that?
It's question, persuade, and refer.
Okay.
So it's another training to look at how you ask someone about suicide, how you persuade them to get some assistance, and where you refer them to, or how you refer them.
Okay, good. And Chief Hogue, I wanted to ask you just one more thing that I had written this down, and I know that earlier we said this might be a sensitive topic, but you also do sort of a safekeeping of weapons thing. You'd mentioned that for tell us how that works. Family members ask you if they can bring weapons to put in a safe, or what do you do exactly?
Yeah, it's, you know, we know that firearms are the most lethal means of committing suicide, and if we can put some time and distance between someone who may be having those thoughts, it just made some sense, almost like Stacy was talking about the pill analogy that she used. And so many times when our officers will respond to calls and they're dealing with an individual who's in crisis, they will offer to accept their firearms and take them for safekeeping. And we do that several times a year. Basically, we'll take the firearms, we'll put them into our a locked storage at the police department, and then they can, when they're out of crisis, they can come and pick those up at any time. And that program has, again, been very successful. Sometimes we will take firearms and put them in safekeeping, and many times we've had them for 3 or 4 years, and we contact the families back, and they say, you know what, we've just decided we don't want those anymore, and so we'll dispose of
them. Is that right?
Yeah. So it's been a very successful program. Again, we don't take weapons from anyone. It's just offered if someone wants to have us keep them to create some time and distance between that situation, then we will do that. And it, again, been very successful.
Okay. And you are listening to our annual Spokane Public Radio Health Forum Suicide Awareness.
This is the end of part one of the 2-hour Spokane Public Radio Health Forum Suicide Awareness, which took place on March 22, 2017, and was hosted and created by Spokane Public Radio's Steve Jackson. We've had support for this broadcast and this program from the Journal of Business, the Inland Northwest source for local healthcare industry news, serving the local business community in print, online, and on the go, SpokaneJournal.com. Kaufman & Associates, a Native American consultant firm specializing in event coordination, multimedia product design, research, and organizational consultation. Details at kaufmaninc.com. Also, Providence Healthcare, serving the region for generations through knowledge, skills, and experienced caregivers dedicated to helping create healthier communities together. Information at phc.org. And WSU, opening the state's second public medical school with the first 2 years of education in Spokane. More at spokane.wsu.edu. Part two will follow.